What I'm going to present today, I have a lot of data. It's the first time that I've sort of thrown all these experiments into a single talk, so I don't really know how long it's going to take. It might be way too much. It's probably not going to be way too little. So please bear with me, and hopefully I'll be able to get through it all. Am I blocking the screen at all? Okay. I'm going to start out by playing Defend Your Research Area, which is a good game, especially for graduate students to learn how to play, because periodically people will ask you, why should we care about that topic that you're doing research on? And periodically we lose sight of why we should care. So why should we care about jurors' perceptions of eyewitness testimony? There are several reasons. It is important because jurors use their knowledge of identification witnesses to make judgments about witnesses. And for the most part, I'll talk about identification witnesses as opposed to eyewitnesses, because one of the studies that I'll talk about uses auditory identifications, or ear witnesses as they're often called. But it'll mainly be eyewitnesses. And in making these judgments, jurors are relying to some extent on their knowledge, and that is important in determining whether they weigh the evidence properly, which will help them convict the guilty, acquit the innocent, all of that sort of thing. In terms of expert testimony, judges very often rely on judges' expectations about what jurors know about eyewitness memory in deciding whether or not to admit expert testimony. And a couple of the studies that I'll present look at the effect of expert testimony on some of these issues on jurors. And for any of you who are interested possibly in trial consulting, what people bring with them to the courtroom and what they expect about eyewitness testimony can be important in selecting jurors who hold the particular beliefs that are going to be most favorable to your clients. And that's all applied stuff. There are some very good practical reasons for why we should care about this issue. There's also a theoretical reason having to do with meta-memory, where jurors' knowledge of how eyewitness memory works is an interesting question within the larger field of meta-memory research, which, as most of you are probably aware, has to do with knowledge of and beliefs about how memory works, both how memory works in general and one's own memory abilities. Do I know this? How does my memory work? And that sort of thing. I'm not going to talk too much about the theoretical angle, but it is another way of kind of justifying the research. One of the things that makes it interesting to me is that it's not only applied research, but can address some of these interesting theoretical questions. And meta-memory judgments in general are relevant in a number of settings, educational settings, for example, where students make JOL, or judgment of learning, assessments, which some of you might be familiar with. It's essentially looking at students' own subjective judgment of whether they have mastered some material, so students studying for a test and judging that, yeah, I've learned it well enough, I'll be able to produce it on demand on a test, and students are not always very accurate about that, which has important implications for their academic performance. It comes into play very often in dealing with special populations, such as children and the elderly. I know an area of interest for many of you here where children's metamemory and also elderly adults' metamemory is in many ways inferior to adolescents and especially young adults' memory as far as being less accurate judges of their own memory abilities. And it comes into play in evaluating others' memory, as in the case of eyewitnesses. Overall, people are not particularly accurate in judging how well their memory works. Eyewitness memory is kind of a curious phenomenon in a lot of ways, and I refer to it as sometimes the eyewitness memory paradox. I've only been referring to it that way for about 2 days because I came up with the term while preparing my talk, but I kind of like it. And what I'm trying to get at is that everyone knows that memory is fallible. The best proof of this is some anecdotal evidence that I've been collecting for years, where when people ask me what I do, all psychologists go through this. You know, you learn that you don't say I'm a psychologist because they say, ooh, I gotta be careful what I say. Around you, you're gonna be analyzing me, blah, blah, blah. So now I say I'm a research psychologist or I'm a psychology professor, and they say, what do you do research on? And I do research on memory and on decision making. So I've been conducting this little informal study. If I say I do research on memory, roughly 95% of people say, oh, I should take your class. My memory's terrible. You know, I need to learn how to have a better memory. But I vary it, and sometimes I say, I do research on decision making, and I have never had anyone say, oh, I should take your class. I make terrible decisions. You know, this guy I married, it was totally the wrong choice. Never, ever has anyone said that. So for meta-memory, we all know that we make these memory errors constantly, but people think they're very good decision makers. So we know that our memories are fallible, we know that other people's memories are fallible, yet eyewitness testimony is enormously influential. And studies show that compared to other kinds of evidence, almost nothing is as influential as eyewitness testimony. DNA evidence, and Valerie can talk about that, is maybe one type of evidence that gets there. And in some circumstances, expert testimony, as I'll talk about on other issues, can be very influential. But an eyewitness reporting on his or her memory is incredibly influential. And the DNA exoneration data show this quite poignantly, distressingly, to some extent, that about 75% of individuals who have been exonerated by DNA testing were convicted in large part based on erroneous identifications. 75 to 80% of the exonerations involve eyewitness error, is what the studies show. And in some of those cases, the only evidence against the defendant was an eyewitness's testimony. It is customary in talking about eyewitness issues to start with a horrific false conviction story. So here's mine. In this case, it was in 1985. A student at Texas Tech University in Lubbock, Texas, named Michelle Mallon, was raped at knife point and robbed. She got a very good look at her assailant, who accosted her while she was in or near her car, but they made her drive him outside of town where he committed the assault and then drove with her back into town where he abandoned her. She described the perpetrator to police as a young African-American man. She described his clothing and said that he had smoked cigarettes during their time together. 2 weeks later, police arrested a man named Timothy Cole, a student and also 26-year-old Army veteran. She positively identified him in a photo lineup and subsequent live lineup. She identified him again at his trial for aggravated sexual assault. Timothy Cole had a pretty good defense. Witnesses testified that on the night of the crime, they had observed him studying at home where his brother was hosting a card game, so there were multiple witnesses at the house. He had severe asthma, so not only did he not smoke, there was lots of evidence that he could not smoke without really bad things happening to him because of his medical condition. Victims of previous similar rapes viewed the same lineup and failed to pick him out. There had been a series of assaults in the area that the police believed were the work of a serial rapist. Similar attacks continued to occur after his arrest. Forensic evidence, such as blood testing and hair testing, were inconclusive. So it did not exonerate him, but also did not conclusively show that it was him. So it seems like he had a pretty good defense. The only strong evidence against him was the victim identifying him in a lineup, which led the jury to convict him after all of 6 hours of deliberation. He was sentenced to 25 years in prison. After the statute of limitations had passed, another prisoner confessed to the crime, but before he could be released, he died in prison. And he was exonerated posthumously by DNA testing, which implicated this other man, and he received a pardon after his death, and Texas created this fund to help ensure that things like that don't happen again, or at least don't happen as often. And this case shows, like, so, you know, it's one case. If you go to the Innocence Project website, you can read these cases till you have tears streaming down your face. many cases like this where there's an eyewitness, that's the person, I'm absolutely sure it was him, no other evidence, he's convicted. And the latest tally on the Innocence Project website is several hundred such cases. I didn't check to see what it's currently at. Last time I checked, I think it was around 300, but clearly a very low-end estimate of the number of such cases. How then do we explain this paradox? You know, you ask anyone, is your memory perfect? Is anyone's memory perfect? Of course not. You know, I can't remember half the stuff I wish I could remember. Eyewitness says, this is what I remember, we tend to believe that person. How do we explain the paradox? There are likely multiple factors. This woman was the victim of a brutal crime, so jurors naturally feel sympathy for the victim. There are certain assumptions about the legal system. He wouldn't be on trial unless the police at least were pretty convinced that he was the guy who committed the crime. So these things come into play as well, but a lot of it is what some researchers refer to as the confidence heuristic, where we tend to believe that people who are more confident are more likely to be accurate than people who are less confident. But the fact of the matter is simply that confidence is not a very good predictor of accuracy, as you all know. It's a better predictor under some circumstances than others, and it is, on balance, meta-analyses show, a statistically significant predictor, but it is still weakly predictive of accuracy and not a very good cue. There are much better cues to use in estimating whether a witness is accurate or not, some of which I will talk about, but people, for the most part, are not aware of those factors that really do predict eyewitness accuracy. So, lay people, which includes prospective jurors, have erroneous beliefs about eyewitness memory. They expect some things like confidence to matter when they don't. They expect that some things don't matter. A number of system and estimator variables, which I'll talk about next, which actually do. And very often they disagree with memory experts about, you know, what's the state of the research as far as what affects memory and what does not. According to experts, lay people, and I'll present some data on this shortly, lay people often are at odds with the expert. And many of you are probably familiar with this distinction between system and estimator variables. It comes up a great deal in eyewitness research. It was first developed by Gary Wells in 1978 was the first paper that he published with this distinction. So it's been around for a while, and courts now use it in talking about eyewitness memory as well. System variables are factors that are under the legal system's control, such as how do you administer a lineup, what instructions do you give, how many people are in the lineup, how do you choose the foils for the lineup. How do you conduct an interview, things like the cognitive interview versus more traditional interviewing techniques. These are all factors which can influence the accuracy of an eyewitness's memory, or at least the amount of information that you get, and in many cases the accuracy that the legal system has virtually total control over. The authorities determine how do I put the lineup together. Estimator variables, on the other hand, are factors that also predict eyewitness performance. Witnesses might do relatively well, relatively poorly, but that are not controllable. So they estimate eyewitness performance. Things like characteristics of the witness and the perpetrator and the event, the gender, the race, the age of the witness and so forth. What was the lighting like? Was the witness under a great deal of stress? All of these sorts of factors having to do with the event and the people involved, but that we can't control. Nonetheless, it might be useful to know about these things in order to judge whether the witness is accurate or not. And some people have argued that what we really need to focus on are the system variables, because those are the things that we can control and that we can change. And Gary Wells and a number of other people have been very influential in getting the legal system to adopt more evidence-based procedures for enhancing the accuracy of eyewitness identifications. And it's kind of a nice success story for how psychological research can influence policy And it's been going on for a while, but really in the last 5 years, it seems like they've, you know, sort of hit the tipping point or something. A lot of courts are really doing that, which is wonderful to see. And I by no means mean to detract from the importance of that research. My argument, however, is that we do still need to worry about estimator variables, even though they're uncontrollable. Understanding estimator variables can help various parties, jurors, which will be my focus, but also judges and the police, form a more accurate evaluation of eyewitnesses as they work with witnesses in working through the system. There's also the theoretical angle, the meta-memory component, but even the more practical component. If police understand better about how these estimator variables are going to influence memory, then they can, you know, adjust their dealings with an individual eyewitness accordingly, depending on some of those characteristics. In doing research on lay people's beliefs about eyewitness memory, there are a number of techniques that people use. Most of the research adheres to one of three different methodologies. So I'll talk about each one briefly, but I'm going to focus more on jury simulations because that's the main sort of research that I do. For now, I just want to point out that using multiple methods is important for convergent validity, because if you get the same results using multiple methods, you can be more confident that the results are generalizable. It can be problematic if the results are inconsistent across methods, which they are a little bit, but for the most part, they're pretty consistent. The most common approach is the eyewitness memory questionnaire, where individuals, lay people in many studies, but also studies of other populations, such as experts. There have been a number of studies of legal professionals looking at what defense attorneys, prosecuting attorneys, police officers, and judges know about eyewitness memory. A few really nice studies of judges just in the last few years, done by Richard Wise at the University of North Dakota, has done some good studies of judges. There are some cross-national comparisons as well. And the methodology varies a little bit, but all of these studies simply ask people about different eyewitness memory topics. For example, this study by Benton a few years ago asked people to indicate their agreement or disagreement with a number of statements, and they looked at system variables and estimator variables. I just pulled a few of the estimator variables that are relevant to some of the studies that I'll be talking about later. But to give you some examples of what the statements were like, their cross-race question was, eyewitnesses are more accurate when identifying members of their own race than members of other races. Do you agree with that or not? In some studies, it's agree or disagree. Others, they rate it on a scale, that sort of thing. As you can see for that question, 90% of experts said, oh yeah, the cross-race effect, that's a real phenomenon. We know that that's true. Less than half of the jurors in their study agreed with that statement, meaning that half of jurors were ignorant about the cross-race effect. Weapon focus, and I won't take the time to go through all of them unless you really want me to, but the weapon focus statement is the presence of a weapon impairs an eyewitness's ability to accurately identify the perpetrator's face. And again, the large majority of experts agree that that's true. The majority of jurors are not familiar with the weapon focus effect. And the agreement figures clearly vary across topic. So people are more knowledgeable about some topics than others. But overall, jurors are not doing all that well, at least compared to the gold standard of expert knowledge. Jurors are relatively ignorant. Yes?
I'm just curious, Brian, is the ID speed when the pop-out effect that you're quicker if you're accurate?
Yes. Quicker if you're accurate or more accurate if you're quicker, whichever way it goes. The wording on that one was that the more quickly a witness makes an identification upon seeing the lineup, the more accurate he or she is likely to be. Yeah. And curiously here, not that many of the experts agree with that, even though the research does tend to support that pop-out effect, that if you make your identification within, I think, 10 to 12 seconds is a rough tipping point there. Yeah,
we're all familiar with it here.
Yes. Yeah, he did some of the early work, and Ziggy Spoor, right. And more recently Neil Brewer has done some of that work, supporting David's findings. That there is a correlation there. So I'm not quite sure why the expert agreement on that item is so low. I suspect that it's because the gold standard kind of for the expert data comes from a study that Saul Kassin and colleagues published in 2001, and it's still the one that people use when they get new samples of legal professionals or jurors and they compare it to the 2001 expert data. But we have 13 more years of data for the experts to formulate their opinions.
There is the speed accuracy trade-off issue. Right. Yeah. That's a classic finding, right. Too.
Yeah.
So this is something that comes up a lot, of course, in system one, system two kind of discussions, right? So you get faster, more accurate for things like this, and then you get slower, more accurate in all huge numbers of areas of psychology. So experts will be saying, well, do you mean speed accuracy trade-off, or do you mean this body?
All right. And I think for a lot of these items where the experts show some disagreement, it's because it's a one-word statement without many qualifiers, and experts who really know the literature are thinking, well, you know, under some circumstances, yes, but under other circumstances, no.
Well, and it isn't really even clear which circumstances you get one and where you get the opposite relationship, but, you know, at least it's not, I'm not completely, I mean, I know that this is what's obtained, but why would you have speed accuracy trade-offs in the rest of the psychology and not have it here?
Yeah. Yeah, and you'd expect that at some point, if you get too fast, you might start to do less well.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, that's true.
Oh, yeah.
One of the nice things about the Benton study, which I don't have here, is that they did have also a group of judges and a group of police officers answer the same questions. And what they found was that those two groups were in between. On balance, they were a little more knowledgeable than jurors, but they still did not do nearly as well as the experts, suggesting that the people who are making the kind of the frontline decisions about eyewitnesses still harbor some misconceptions. And there have been now probably a couple dozen of these sorts of questionnaire studies, which show a pretty consistent pattern. There's variability depending on the topic, like in the previous slide, but for the most part, lay people don't know a whole lot. Things that we know affect eyewitness memory, they're unaware of. Things that we know are not great predictors, like confidence, they tend to be very accepting of that sort of statement. There's some research done mainly by Don Reed and colleagues showing that the manner in which you ask the questions affects the results, the wording of the question, whether you provide contextual information and examples in the question can influence the result, the sorts of response options, whether it's yes, no, multiple choice, open-ended, that sort of thing, whether you have a don't know option can influence people's apparent knowledge, how well they do on these questions. But for the most part, still, they're not doing that great. A couple of recent findings, and Desmarais and Reed did a meta-analysis on this literature that they published a few years ago, and they found that the results are pretty consistent across countries, but where there are differences, Canadians are smarter.
And,
yes, you think he has a bias? You think he has a bias there?
Brian, can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Do these questionnaires, in addition to specific estimate questions, do they ever include a question that, let's just say, a global gist of the reliability of eyewitness identification? Because I can well imagine that there's been a lot of publicity on that. I think almost as much or more as there has been publicity on the unreliability of young child witnesses, for example. I remember Gary Wells on Oprah and all this sort of thing. And I could imagine a circumstance in which jurors would think, oh, you know, that thing isn't a problem at all, but man, eyewitness identified, they're really unreliable, you know, as a class.
Yeah.
It's
an interesting question. Usually not. There are a couple studies that do. There's a Swedish group, Jusslin and Olsen, have done some studies where they really take more of a meta-memory kind of approach. So they ask people, how good is your memory? How good are people's memories in general? How reliable are eyewitnesses in general? And kind of looking at it from a different perspective, the surveys that ask about specific topics, to my knowledge, they don't. But one of the things that it suggests is that is the last point that I have here, where in the meta-analysis, they looked at whether there was an effect, a possible moderating effect of the date of the study to see if people are becoming more knowledgeable over time. And they found that on some topics, they are, where people, if you look at that in the oldest studies that I'm aware of are kind of early 80s. So you have a 30-year period. And they found that more recent studies have shown that people know more than they did in the earlier studies, which they attribute to publicity. Not just awareness of Innocence Project, false convictions, but also crime shows, where shows like Law and Order and CSI. And that's a little bit of a double-edged sword, because as I've argued in some of my other work, those shows perpetuate a lot of the myths about memory, but to some extent, they might also be making people aware that eyewitnesses do commit these errors, and certainly having people like Barry Scheck and Gary Wells and Elizabeth Loftus on shows like Oprah in 2020 and 60 Minutes, and they've all been on, you know, various of these shows. The word is getting out there about some of these issues, and that's what they think explains the chronological effect, which makes sense to me. The prediction studies, I'm not going to say too much about them other than to give you an idea of how this methodology is conducted. It's the most challenging one to do, which is why I always tip my hat to people like Steve Cece who take the time to perform these sorts of studies. These studies are usually two-phase studies where, and I realized this morning I didn't have a chance to fix it, instead of lay witnesses, that should say lay judges. Lay judges or evaluators. So in the first phase of the study, you have people witness something, and then in the second phase of the study, the evaluators or judges, not professional judges, but just people who are evaluating the witnesses, they hear or read about or see the testimony or the memory reports of the witnesses, some of whom are accurate and some of whom are inaccurate, and then they simply try to predict, was this particular witness an accurate witness or not, usually in terms of the identification that they made. And what they find is that whether the witness was accurate or not generally fails to affect judgments of accuracy, and Gary Wells and Rod Lindsay did several papers along these lines in the early and mid-1980s, overwhelmingly, what affects people's judgments of whether a witness was accurate or not is the witness's confidence level, even though it's not a very good cue. And much of the research shows that this is true when judging children as well as adults. That's why I cite the Sam Stone study, for example, that Steve published some years ago, showing that when adults are judging child witnesses, they are also not very good at predicting whether they're correct or not. And I have qualifiers like generally and largely, because the research literature is not unanimous, and there are a few studies out there, such as the recent one by Smallars and Wells, showing that people are better than chance. But the majority of studies, and I haven't seen a meta-analysis of it, but the majority of studies in my reading does suggest that people are not very good at predicting whether an individual witness is correct. That brings us to the last methodology, the jury simulation study, and I won't take too much time to go over methodology in general. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have, because it's a particular interest that I have, is different research methods used for conducting this sort of research. But it differs from the prediction studies in that rather than evaluating actual witnesses, it's a hypothetical case, a mock trial that the researchers have created in which there is an identification witness, usually an eyewitness. And typically, it's a full trial. A lot of the prediction studies. It's not really in the trial context. It's just, here's this a videotape of this witness. Do you think this person is accurate or not? The simulation studies here. There's a full trial, other witnesses, other evidence. A few studies have used deliberating juries. Well, not really even a few, maybe one or two. Most of them use individual mock jurors, and it allows researchers to manipulate a number of variables. Is there an identification witness or not? An identification witness versus other kinds of witness, such as polygraph evidence or DNA evidence. And the last few things here, which I'll be focusing on, looking at the effect on jurors of different types of variables related to the witnessing situation or the manner in which the identification was conducted, to see if jurors' decisions, especially their verdicts, are influenced by some of these factors which we know make eyewitness memory better or worse. Some of them, including one or two that I'll talk about, include expert testimony, and some of them, including the ones that I'll look at, that I'll present, also include measures of what the mock jurors believe about memory. So if people expect that a certain factor is going to affect memory, and then you manipulate that factor, is there an interaction effect between these two things? I have a number of studies that all use more or less the same methodology, except they're looking at different variables. So I'll spend a little more time going over the first one to familiarize you with the methodology, and then the others pretty much follow the same pattern, using different variables, different trials, some different measures. And I want to give you a flavor of the variety of variables that I've looked at over a number of different studies, so I won't go into depth about the results of any one, but just sort of select individual research findings. I can give you the citations and send you the papers if you want more detail. In this first study, we were interested in juror sensitivity to the cross-race effect, which again is the finding that people are better at identifying individuals of their own race or ethnicity than individuals of other races or ethnicities. And some research actually generalizes that to more of an in-group, out-group phenomenon, even within a race, ethnicity. Spohr has done some great research in Germany, for example, looking at Germans versus Turks. So if you can distinguish, and Kurt Hugenberg has done some in-group, out-group stuff showing similar sorts of findings. But most of it looks at racial ethnic differences. So here we were looking at whether people's judgments in a mock trial situation would reflect an awareness of differences in witness race. We had white and black undergraduate participants and looked at the effect of that variable as well as the eyewitness's race. The defendant in our case was always African-American. Would have been ideal, yes, to vary that as well, but it was very hard to recruit African-American participants at LSU, where this research was done, which is why we didn't have the fully crossed design. Nonetheless, with the black defendant, according to the cross-race effect, the witness, an African-American defendant, should be viewed as more credible, more reliable, because that is the same race as the person that he saw commit the crime, compared to the white eyewitness. There were other witnesses as well in the trial. After the trial had ended, we had a questionnaire about a number of different factors, one of which was the cross-race effect, so that we could measure whether people really knew about the cross-race effect or not, and asked them to render a verdict, estimate how confident they were in their verdict, and they also evaluated each of the witnesses on these various measures, perceived accuracy, credibility, and how important the witnesses' testimony was. And we predicted that there would be a main effect of mock juror race. We thought that there would be more guilty verdicts given by white jurors than black jurors, partly because other research shows that in cases where race is not salient, there is a same race leniency effect, and partly because of research showing that African Americans tend to distrust the legal system compared to whites. And I've done some unrelated research recently showing that compared to other minority groups, African Americans trust the legal authorities, especially criminal justice system authorities, less than other minorities do. We did not expect there to be an effect of eyewitness race based on lay people's ignorance of most estimator variables. And yes, I realize that we're predicting the null effect, more or less, there. But it would be interesting either way to see if there was an effect, it's interesting. If there's not an effect, it's interesting. And we also looked at the relationship between jurors' knowledge of the cross-race effect and the manipulation of the race of the eyewitness variable. Oops. There we go. This just shows the difference as a function of race of the mock jurors. White jurors, as we expected, were more likely to convict the defendant in this case than black jurors, 50% to a little less than 30%. There was no effect of the eyewitness race on verdicts, nor was there an interaction. And we got the same result when we combine the verdict and confidence to create a continuous measure. This table shows the results for witness credibility, and here we had three different witnesses, two prosecution witnesses, the eyewitness and the police detective who led the investigation and administered the lineup, and an alibi witness, the defendant's roommate or girlfriend. After a while, all the trials I use sort of run together in my mind. But someone who provided an alibi for the defendant. And as you can see here, there was a strong effect of participant race for all of these measures. White participants tended to find the prosecution witnesses more credible, the eyewitness and the detective, than did the African-American participants, and for the defense witness, the reverse was true. There was some effect of the race of the eyewitness where the black eyewitness was perceived as more credible than the white eyewitness. And this was especially true here, and this is the interaction where the effect of eyewitness race was very strong for black participants, but for white participants it's negligible and non-significant, which seems to suggest that the black participants are more sensitive to the cross-race effect than the white participants. And indeed, when we asked them about the cross-race effect after the experiment, and again, it was embedded in a longer questionnaire, so we weren't saying, now that you've just watched a trial about a black defendant, what do you think about the cross-race effect? We found that, indeed, black participants were more knowledgeable about the cross-race effect. They were more likely to get that question right. So that is good also. The downside is that we then did some analyses, and I don't have a slide for it, but we looked at whether there were differences in verdict between people who knew about the cross-race effect and those who did not know about the cross-race effect, where the prediction would be, you know, people who know about the cross-race effect, they should distinguish between white and black witnesses, and people who don't know about the cross-race effect, well, they should not. There was no interaction. People were just as likely to be influenced by the race of the eyewitness whether they knew about the cross-race effect or not. So what we see, which comes up in some of the other research as well, is that there's disjunction between what people know and what they report knowing and whether it actually plays out in their behavior. And that's true throughout this literature, that you get effects on this measure but not that measure. And yeah, they say they know it on the questionnaire, but then you do a mock jury study and it doesn't come out, and so forth. Sure.
In a way, the black eyewitness is the one who is a prosecution witness, is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, in a way, I'm linking that to the comments that you just made about the differences that people of different racial and ethnic backgrounds have toward the criminal justice system. In a way, the Black eyewitness is embedded within this, you know, presumably mm-hmm. racist system, and helps to counteract some of that. Would that fit the pattern of data that you saw in that study?
It could, and it's interesting to think about when you have a minority testify for the system,
yeah.
how is that person going to be perceived?
Yeah. With more credibility.
Yeah, with more credibility perhaps, because if he's willing to go along and testify, mm-hmm. not that he necessarily has a choice in the matter, it could make him that credible. So that could be part of it. You know, I hadn't thought about that, but that could be why the Black participants especially see the Black eyewitness as so credible. And there's been some other research done. There hasn't been a lot of research that I know of looking at race of witnesses, but Amina Memon did a study a few years ago looking at the race and gender of expert witnesses, where she manipulated, if I'm remembering it correctly, the race and gender of an expert witness so that the expert was obviously male or female and white or African American, and then measured people's perceived credibility and verdicts, of course. And the most influential, most credible expert witness was the Black woman, which goes against expectations a little bit, because if there's prejudice and that sort of thing, you would expect that the minority expert would be perceived differently. But their explanation is that, you know, it's because this person has defied expectation. You know, and this person is, you know, an accomplished professional and is engaging in this context. So there must be something to it. This person must be really good. If you're a Black woman and you're an expert witness, wow, you must be great to be doing this job. If you're a white man, you know, we have lots of white male experts, so maybe you're not so impressive. But it's definitely an area that needs to be looked at more, I think. I can tell I'm not going to get through nearly all of this. I want to make sure we have time for questions. So we go till 3, is that right? Okay. Well, I'll do maybe one or two more quick studies. And then if you have questions about the others, I can answer them or send them to you. The second study uses a different trial, but more or less the same methodology, looking at different variables, where here we are interested in the weapon focus effect and witness age, where the effects on memory, as I mentioned earlier, if there's a weapon present or visible, identifications are less accurate, and child witnesses as well as elderly adult witnesses tend to be less accurate than adult witnesses. We used an armed robbery trial in which we manipulated those two factors. It was a convenience store robbery. The crime was the same. The weapon, there always was a weapon, because whether there's a weapon or not is going to determine what charge there can be in this case. So there always had to be a weapon, but it was either visible or not and seen by the witness or not. And we manipulated the age of the eyewitness, a customer at the store, 6, 11, 42, or 74 years old, as part of a questionnaire. We asked their beliefs about weapon focus as well as witness age, so that we could include here what participants believed or expected about eyewitness memory as a predictor. And we expected that people would find younger witnesses and elderly witnesses less credible. So the middle-aged adult witness more credible and hence more guilty verdicts in that condition. We expected the main effect of weapon presence. But the main thing that we were interested in was the interaction between people's expectations and the estimator variable itself, where we predicted that when their expectations and the actual state of affairs, what occurred in this case, were congruent, their verdicts would be more in line with that congruency than when they were incompatible. So if they believed that younger witnesses are believable, are credible, and the witness was young, then the witness should be, young witness should be more credible and should lead to more verdicts. And for verdicts, there was a main effect of age, but not an interaction. They did convict more when the eyewitness was a middle-aged adult than when the eyewitness was a child or a 74-year adult. I had something else there. Guess not. My study's mixed up. That shouldn't be study two. This is still the same study. And looking at the second study here, looked at identification speed, which we talked about earlier, but I won't have time for that. And looking at weapon presence, we did find the predicted interaction where it's a little hard to break down, but the x-axis here is the strength of belief in the weapon focus effect. So strongly agree means you know about the weapon focus effect. So if you know about the weapon focus effect and there was a weapon present in the crime, the dotted line, then the eyewitness is not very credible because you know that if there's a weapon, it can lead people to make errors and you don't believe the witness. On the other hand, if you disagree with the weapon focus effect, or you're not aware of it, and there is a weapon present, you find the witness very credible, and then the crossover interaction, more or less crossing over despite some hills and valleys in there when that weapon was not present, showing this interaction between what people expect to occur and the actual state of affairs. I'm going to skip that. That third study that I'm skipping over and this one are very similar. This one replicates and extends some of the previous findings. The estimator variable here is eyewitness stress. So the effect on memory is complex. But is generally that stress has negative effects on eyewitness memory. In some respects, it can have positive effects or no effects, but on balance, I have argued in a few articles that being under a high degree of stress or arousal has negative effects on eyewitness performance. So here we manipulated the eyewitness's stress level, where we used a similar sort of trial, an armed robbery, and the eyewitness was in the store and observed it. At trial, she testified that she was really freaking out and her heart was pounding, her hands were sweating, et cetera, et cetera. Or she said, I was very calm, you know, I was worried about my safety, but I didn't think he could see me and I felt okay. So relatively low stress considering she witnessed an armed robbery. We manipulated the stress in the actual crime, and we measured people's beliefs about whether stress in eyewitnesses tends to have a positive or negative effect on memory, so looking at their beliefs again. And we also included a manipulation of expert testimony where research on expert testimony often distinguishes between this idea of skepticism and sensitization, where one of the effects that an expert witness could have is that they just don't believe the witness. So the expert talks about all of these limitations to eyewitness memory, and that leads people to think, well, I'm not going to believe the eyewitness then, because the expert said eyewitnesses suck. You know. Excuse me. That's what happens when you make me give two talks back to back, Valerie. My voice starts to go. The more desirable situation would be what the literature refers to as sensitization, where the expert testimony enables jurors or other decision makers to distinguish between good witnesses and bad witnesses, depending on characteristics of the witness and the event, and so forth. And if you show sensitization, it's a pretty compelling argument for why experts would be useful trial in these cases. And here we manipulated the content of the expert testimony. There was a condition with no expert testimony, one where the expert testifies about some of the problems with eyewitness memory but doesn't say anything about stress and arousal. Then in the last two conditions, the expert talks about the general problems but also talks about stress. And in one condition, the expert says, yeah, you know, despite all those problems, stress, when a witness is under high stress, that helps memory, and people remember better when there are a lot of stress. And then in this last condition, says exactly the opposite. And our predictions, again, we're looking at the interactions with belief, where if people believe that stress is conducive to good memory and the eyewitness is under a high degree of stress, they should believe the witness. As opposed to the other way around, and the same sort of congruence with the content of the expert testimony. And what we found was pretty much that when the expert testified that that stress has a negative effect on memory, or the expert didn't talk about arousal at all, there was a difference as a function of what people believe. So it's believe stress helps, believe stress hurts. That's whether people's prior belief was that stress is helpful or has a harmful effect on memory. Here, those two groups produce different verdicts when there's no expert or the expert testifies that that stress helps memory, there's no difference. And on culpability, we get the predicted interaction between what people believe and what the witness actually experienced. When people believe that stress makes memory better and the witness was under a high degree of stress, they find the defendant more culpable. And when they believe that stress has a negative effect on memory, and the witness is under a relatively low level of stress, they find the defendant more culpable. And so, as with the earlier research that I talked about, we're finding the predicted effects on some measures but not others, which is not ideal, but as we all know, that's research. What are you going to do? We'll get to that last study because I want to make sure we have time for some questions. On the whole, what can we take from all of this? There are several things. The first thing is that jurors don't know a lot about eyewitness memory. The various methodologies used to study jurors' knowledge or lay people's knowledge, some studies have used actual jurors, most use students or citizens, show that people are not very knowledgeable across these different methodologies. They are much less knowledgeable than we would like. My research in particular, focusing on the role of belief, shows that what people believe is influential in how they evaluate witnesses and looking at that interaction between what they believe and the circumstances of the particular incident that they are dealing with, some inconsistency across the different dependent measures. The implications here, and I mentioned a couple of these before, for jury selection, people's beliefs matter. So if you're a trial consultant, you want to try and assess people's naive expectations about eyewitnesses, if the judge allows it, which usually the judge won't, but occasionally you find a friendly judge who will. If eyewitness memory is not a matter of common sense, then it suggests that judges should be more willing to allow expert testimony to address some of these issues. There are implications for juror education, where if jurors are ignorant, we need to educate them. And that is something that expert witnesses do or can do. But given that expert testimony, at least on this issue, is somewhat controversial and is not always likely to be allowed by the judge, researchers have tried to find some alternative means of informing jurors. And one of the more promising ones is a technique developed by Paul Lenko and colleagues called the III. It's capital I, capital I, EYE, and it's something like one I is identification and one is eyewitness and, oh, interviewing. Identification, interviewing, eyewitness, I think is what it stands for. And it was basically a 15-minute tutorial about eyewitness memory that they gave to mock jurors before the trial. And then they presented them with the trial, which manipulated a lot of system variables and estimator variables. And mock jurors who got this tutorial were better able to distinguish between good witnesses and bad witnesses and those who weren't. So it was really promising. You still have to convince the judge to allow you to do that. But given the issues with expert testimony, it could be beneficial. And then lastly, using different research methods is a useful way of demonstrating convergent validity. And just in the research that I've talked about and the research that I skipped over, so you didn't see it, using different trials, different measures, different groups of participants, different ways of presenting the trial, and so forth. And lastly, and of course, a number of students, and I want to be sure to mention that the research that I've talked about was the result of 3 undergraduate honors theses, 1 dissertation, and a couple of other just for fun sorts of projects. So in particular, Jordan Abshire, Ashley Christensen, and Tess Neal were all undergraduate honors students that I worked with. So thank you, and hopefully I left a little time for questions.